We're back at the Radio Cafe. We're at Santa Fe Baking Company, and I'm Hollis Walker, your guest host today. My second guest this morning is Dr. Donald Kalshed, a psychotherapist in private practice in Albuquerque. He's a training analyst with the Interregional Society of Jungian Analysts, and he's written many articles in analytical psychology and lectures widely on the subject of early trauma and its treatment. His first book was in 1996, Inner Trauma, followed by the book we'll be talking about today, Trauma and the Soul, which came out last fall. Dr. Kalshed spoke recently in the lecture series of the Jungian Society of Santa Fe, and I attended that lecture, and I'm really glad I showed up early because it was standing room only. He is so well thought of by his peers here in the area. Welcome, Dr. Kalshed.
Thank you, Hollis. Good to be here.
Thank you. In your book, you explain your own theory, or this book is about your own theory of early trauma and how it affects people often throughout their lives. How are you defining early trauma?
Well, early trauma is, trauma in general is experience that we can't experience. That's about as good a definition as we have. In other words, we're simply asked in this life to experience things that we can't metabolize, that we can't bear, that we can't integrate. So anything that's defined as traumatic is something that requires psychological defenses, and the most common one is we call dissociation, and it's the way the psyche seems to divide itself up in order to protect something precious at the core of the psyche from further violation. And so trauma can be the kind of early trauma that we hear so much about in the literature these days, sexual abuse, child abuse, violence in families, or it can be a kind of emotional illiteracy in families where kids don't get any playback or feedback for their feeling expression, a kind of emotional impoverishment or neglect. That can accumulate over time to lead to a traumatic result, and the activation of these defenses that I've described as dissociation.
So in the moment, this dissociation can happen in the moment of experiencing the trauma. You're being beaten as a child, and your reaction, your psychological reaction, might be to see yourself as if from outside?
That's exactly right. I mean, we hear a lot about this. A child who is being beaten or violated sexually finds themselves watching the whole experience from the corner of the ceiling. And in other words, a division has happened so that a part of the self is now outside the self witnessing this, and a part of the self is experiencing it in the body. This is the kind of division between a part that regresses back to a pre-traumatic state to preserve something of the child's innocence, and a part that grows up too fast and sees everything but feels nothing. So that's the kind of division that happens in dissociation. Dissociation is the escape when there is no escape. You know, the child in that situation, totally dependent, can't escape. It's totally dependent on the adult who's violating it, so it escapes with a part of itself. A part of itself leaves. That's the way we understand it.
So some of the... you could actually experience these kinds of traumas before you're actually able to talk or be conscious in the way we think of consciousness as adult consciousness.
That's right. A lot of early trauma occurs before we can verbalize what's going on, and what we know now is that a lot of that early experience is encoded in the right hemisphere of the brain, which is the hemisphere that's online, so to speak, for the first 18 months of life. So this carries really important implications for how we reach that level of trauma in the psychotherapy process. We now know that the usual ways that we've always worked, which are verbal ways and interpretation and insight into what's going on, don't work for this level of early trauma. We have to find ways of accessing the right hemisphere of the brain, and Alan Shore's work is very important here because he's been able to show that various techniques that we use, especially in Jungian psychology, such as dream work, real focus and attention on what people are feeling in their bodies at this very moment in the transference relationship, imaginal techniques like Santre, active imagination, all these things reach the right hemisphere and open up some of these implicit memories that we otherwise can't access.
Let's talk about the person who has had this kind of childhood trauma, who has had dissociative experiences during that. Does that state of separation then continue throughout their lives unless and until something is done to heal the rift?
Well, let's be realistic about this. Trauma is universal. We all are traumatized in more or less. And dissociation is universal. It's a perfectly normal defense. A benign version of it is the kind of self-hypnotic trances that we go into when we're driving or when we wash the dishes or when we're in reverie. We're slightly dissociated in those times, but it's a benign form of dissociation. The kind of dissociation that happens, that comes to a child's rescue when it's really experiencing things that it really can't bear, that level of dissociation causes more difficulty in later life. You can go on living a perfectly normal life from the outside, but when you get into situations, oftentimes in intimate situations, intimate relationships and so forth, where the early trauma comes up, then you start to struggle and you have more difficulty, and that's where psychotherapy becomes important.
Tell me about one of the things you talk about in here, and the book is Trauma and the Soul by Dr. Donald Kalshed, is that people who've had these kinds of experiences often express the idea that they feel they have lost their soul or a part, they're separated from a part of themselves. Can you say some more about that?
That's right. That's an often felt of traumatized experiences is that the one child who is later a patient of mine as an adult described herself as having lost her innocence, having lost her soul, and she complained that she didn't feel real anymore. She lost her ability to play with other kids. This is the spontaneous, expressive part of the self that gets injured or gets chased out of the body when these dissociative defenses occur, so that the child no longer feels really herself. Before the trauma, perhaps she was at one with herself, but now she's beside herself. She can't really feel completely real and open. So psychotherapy becomes necessary then. The reason the soul is important is because what we find is that often these children who have suffered early trauma retreat into a realm that is spiritual in a way. They have experiences of entering a world where they feel safe, and sometimes that world is populated by a guardian angel or an imaginal animal that companions them and keeps them, gives them company in that world. It's a very moving experience. So that the life of the soul in trauma has become very interesting to me, because when the child falls through the crack created by dissociation, she doesn't just fall into oblivion or fall apart. She falls into a world that's already there to catch her, so to speak. And that's the world that Jung talked about as the archetypal world, or that religions talk about as the spirit world.
You know, I want to read right now, there's a great quote by you. One of the wonderful things about your book is that it's beautifully written. It's quite poetic. And your own language, is, even though you also quote a lot of poets, your own language is quite beautiful in cases. You described exactly what you're talking about now. saying, it seems that the process of becoming the self you were intended to be involves the materialization of something spiritual. Some seed of true selfhood needs to make a perilous journey through very dangerous territory, from the world of eternity to the world of time, from spirit to matter, from divine to human, in order to become a human soul. So these children that have these traumatic experiences, as adults, they don't always remember them. Is that correct?
They don't always remember them, no. They may suffer flashback.
Uh-huh.
As close as they can get to the memories. And, you know, they often also walk around with terrible fears of certain experiences that have already happened that they can't remember. So their way of remembering is to fear. Their life is full of fear of the return of those events that they can't remember, which are in the body, so to speak.
So it's sort of a free-floating fear because they can't attach it to anything.
That's right, exactly.
Uh-huh. You also said that people who have this kind of trauma as adults share other characteristics. You were talking about how they may have mystical experiences or feel connected to a spiritual world. And one of the other things that you said is that they're very attracted to the mythopoetic world. Why is that, do you think?
Well, you know, here's the silver lining in the cloud of trauma. I mean, kids who have suffered this kind of dissociation because of unbearable experience often get a privileged glimpse into another world that exists beside this one. We call this the spirit world, the archetypal world, the world of the unconscious, God's world, the eternal world, the divine world, whatever attribution we want to give it, it's real. And trauma survivors have a deep experience of that world often. Not always. I mean, the problem with that spiritual world is that it can be dark as well as light. So the child can feel persecuted by demons in that world as well as rescued by angels. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the people that I've worked with, and I would say here that most of the people I've worked with would qualify for what Elaine Aron calls highly sensitive persons.
Mm-hmm.
She's written a book about a highly sensitive person. They're tuned in to this other world, and therefore they have oftentimes a rich, poetic, cultural life. Many of them are artistic. Many of them are psychic.
Mm-hmm.
They have a sort of privileged access to non-ordinary reality, if you will.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, the only problem with this world is that it, as a permanent solution, it doesn't usually sustain the person indefinitely. It's an alternative world that renders them safe for a while, but usually interpersonal intervention has to come in there in order to personalize those archetypal forces.
So they might, for example, I'm thinking of a friend of mine I knew who had been raped as a very young child, and she painted, she painted horrific images, not directly of that event, but of these frightening characters. And yet, to do that, to think about those events, to make those paintings alone would not be enough, you're saying, to integrate her personality.
Well, you know, I don't know. Each case is unique and
sure.
Different. But let's just take that example without knowing all the details.
Sure.
The psyche wants to remember the events. And so, you know, a trauma survivor like your friend who is talented as an artist or finds herself compelled to paint, the psyche is giving expression to feelings, affects, in symbolic form, right?
Right.
And some of those images will be actual images of probably parts of the experience of the rape. Others will be just, you know, blood-curdling affects and feelings that come up. If she just keeps painting and painting and painting, it can be a kind of a loop that doesn't ever, get out of itself until a witnessing person comes into that scene and starts to ask her questions about the imagery and to associate to the imagery and maybe supplies a secure relationship, a field of warm relatedness and compassion so that she can start to relax a little bit more and start to feel what some of these things mean to her.
And in that process, hopefully with a trained person, the individual, the trauma survivor, can hopefully come to some... Is there some resolution that occurs?
Well, the resolution is the memory. The resolution is the capacity to find and recover what we call implicit memory, which is traumatic experience, which is embedded in the body or in iconic modes of encoding, which aren't available to narrative memory. In other words, the person can't tell the story about their trauma. When they can tell the story about the trauma, including the feelings involved in it, then it no longer restricts the flow of their life energy.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a sad and difficult experience that we carry around with us, those of us who suffered early trauma, but it's no longer something that we suffer in flashbacks and that makes us feel crazy because we can't figure out what's going on inside.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't serve the functions of occluding and breaking up the flow of life into relationship and into life in general.
I'm talking with Dr. Donald Kalshed about his book, Trauma and the Soul. Your book is full of references to the mythopoetic, as we were talking about, to literature, to art, Dante's Inferno, the poetry of William Blake and his imagery as well, Wordsworth, Dickinson, Keats, and there's even a long discussion of Antoine de Saint-Exupéry's The Little Prince. But
yes.
I'm particularly interested in your use of Dante's character Dis, and tell us how you use Dis as a figure to explain your theory.
Well, this occurred to me quite fortuitously. I was good friends with the late Charles Taylor, who along with his wife Patricia Finley wrote a book called The Images of the Journey in Dante's Divine Comedy. Artists, over the years have been fascinated by Dante's Divine Comedy because it's so vivid in its depiction of hell and purgatory and paradise, and they painted this imagery forever. And the one figure, the first third of the comedy is the Inferno, and I got very interested in the Inferno because Dante is depressed in the middle of his life, and the prescription for his depression is that he has to go into hell, right? I mean, psychologically, the idea would be that he has to confront all his unremembered pain in order to recover from his depression. So he gets a witness, his favorite poet, Virgil, and they descend into the Inferno, and they go down and down and down and down through the different gates. Hell is the first gated community. they keep going down and down through these different gates, and in the final level is the monster, the evil one, who controls all the dissociative material in the dissociative experience in hell, and that his name is Dis, D-I-S, and that fascinated me because Dis is the prefix from which we get disease, dysfunction, dissociation, even disaster, which means to come apart from your stars.
Uh-huh.
So here's the Lord of Dissociation at the very bowels of hell, and I'm interpreting hell in my book as an enclave, a kind of autistic enclave, a a place where all of our unremembered and hellish pain gets sequestered, overseen by this figure called Dis. He's a real monster. He's pictured as a three-headed cannibal, eating sinners in each of his gaping jaws. It's really a monstrous image.
So I'd like to go back a little bit and talk about your sort of sum up your theory of what you call it, the self-care system. And just tell us a little more about that.
Well, the self-care system is a sort of a trauma complex. It's a system of defenses that comes into being when the child is experiences trauma. And the way I found that my way to this was certain patients who had an early trauma history, when they started to open up and relax and start to heal, their dreams would picture very violent figures that would be attacking a more vulnerable part of the self. So, for example, a young child or an animal would be attacked by some vicious and violent figure. And I was at pains to try to understand that, because it was clear in the transference work that these people were starting to trust again, were starting to care again, were starting to attach within the transference. And as soon as that attachment happened, this violent figure, who we were just talking about as Dis, came up to try to cut them off from this feeling. And that interested me a great deal, because psychoanalysis has known about this figure for many, many years now. It's been called all kinds of different things. Harsh and archaic superego by Freud, and internal saboteur by Fairbairn, anti-libidinal ego by Guntrip.
Or in the vernacular, the inner critic, right?
The inner critic, exactly.
Right. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. The inner critic, exactly. And there's been a lot of good literature on how to work with the inner critic. But that inner critic is devastating at a time when the person is wanting to heal. So that interested me a great deal, and as I worked with people over the years, I began to see that this self-care system and its violence would transform, so that the critic would cease being critical, and the person and the child in the psyche would begin to thrive. So you can actually see a transformation of the defensive system if you work long enough with people in psychotherapy.
So is this inner tormentor or inner critic, does it have to be appeased, or is it, do you make it your ally? What exactly happens?
You have to understand it. Its origins are that it's doing the best it can to keep the innocent part of you out of further suffering. And if you have that understanding, and can somehow communicate that to this figure, which is not so easy, then it will slowly release its functions of guarding that child in the inner world and turn them over to you, to the therapist or to the partner, so that it releases its prisoners in a way and relaxes its vigilance. It's a very vigilant, scanning, potentially violent figure in the psyche unless it's understood.
So, one way in which I can imagine that might be done would be as one becomes more able to recognize that figure, to be able to say, oh yeah, there you are, I hear you saying those terrible things, but I can handle this now. Or, you know, having some sort of inner dialogue going on with that figure to try.
Absolutely. And Jung's term for that was active imagination. And that's
yes.
One of the ways in which we work with that figure is to actually have a dialogue with it, interview it, and realize that it too has a story. It comes from, the unbearable suffering of the child. It was it was elevated to its position by the defensive system in order to protect the innocent remainder of this child from further violation. And so we want to acknowledge its huge help in the past, you know, but retire it with a gold watch and and make sure it feels appreciated, but now it's not necessary anymore.
Now it's time to go.
it's time to recede into the background.
Yes.
and let the ego take over its functions.
Uh-huh. And you said, you know, it's supposed to protect us from suffering, but if we do not suffer, we can't become our fully authentic selves, can we?
Well, that leads to a very interesting question about the kinds of suffering. There's a lot of suffering in hell, but it's eternal. It never ends.
Yes.
It doesn't complete itself. And what we find is that the kind of suffering that's transformative and necessary in psychotherapy is a more acute opportunity to feel the pain of those early woundings, but with a witness and in a safe environment.
Dr. Kalshed, thank you so much for your time. I've been talking with Dr. Donald Kalshed, author of Trauma and the Soul, and you have been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Hollis Walker, sitting in for Mary Charlotte.